Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing education and training for all UK-registered optometrists. You can gain one CET point by listening to this podcast and completing the exercise on our website, docket.info. I'm Michelle Hanratty. I'm an IP optometrist based in Birmingham and a final examiner for the college's scheme for registration. With case studies and in-depth conversations each month, we're exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. And this month, we're talking to Dr. Denise Attan about suspicious discs. As optometrists, we assess hundreds of optic discs when carrying out eye examinations in routine practice, and we're very good at spotting unusual-looking discs. But navigating through the decision-making process to decide how to manage these patients can be tricky. Being able to identify swollen discs and differentiating them from those that just look a little bit unusual could save a patient's life, not just their vision. So it's important to get it right. Papilledema edema has received a lot of attention in recent years, and whilst it can have devastating consequences, it's important to remember that it is a fairly rare condition and that there are other causes of suspicious looking discs, including benign ones. But before we move on to these other causes, we'll recap on papilledema edema, starting with Shannon's story.
My name is Shannon Brudrig. I live in Corsham in Wiltshire. I woke up on New Year's Day with an incredible headache. I wasn't vomiting, but I was incredibly nauseous. You would think, gosh, such a young person, New Year's Day must have been drinking too much. But no, was not drinking. I had a moment where I just suddenly couldn't see. My vision was very obscured, but I work behind a computer quite a lot and I drive quite a lot as well. So I thought it was maybe just one of those old wives' tales where it was too much screen time or driving too much, a bit of stress. So I just ignored it. As the headache got worse, my vision got worse as well. I had quite a lot of double vision, which was a bit scary because I thought I had four dogs instead of two. But Dr. Google told me that everything was fine. So I just drank some water and carried on with my day. And then I started to notice these bursts of obscured vision happening more frequently. And I was actually driving to Oxford. And I had to pull over on the side of the road because I couldn't see the car in front of me. That's when I realized I needed to make an appointment with the doctor because I was just like, I can't manage this anymore. And while I was sitting on the side of the road, I just got this incredible pain in the back of my neck. That's when I was just like, oh my goodness, someone's going to have to come and fetch me because I don't know how I'm going to get home. After that, I spoke to my GP. And he said that he thinks it would be best if I go to the Bristol Eye Hospital, to the emergency department there, and ask them to have a look at me. So the next day I went to the hospital, and that's when they did some tests and things like that. You know, when you go for a normal eye exam and they test your vision with the eye charts, they did that. But then when they looked at the back of my eyes and they saw that my nerves were so swollen, I also then had CT scans and so on and blood tests because that was when they grew concerned because of the pressure and the swelling. Initially, the doctor said to me that the pressure could be caused by a mass in the brain or by a clot in the brain, or it could be caused by another disease. After that, I was admitted to the Bristol Royal Infirmary. That was quite scary. And then the next morning, I went and I had another CT scan to see if there was a clot in my brain. And then they said that it wasn't. So we'd ruled out the tumor, we'd ruled out the clot. And now it was just to find out if it was the idiopathic intracranial hypertension. And the next morning, we did the lumbar puncture. After that, they let me go home. I thought maybe my eyes would get better over time now that I'd had the lumbar puncture, but it just didn't. So the following week, I went back to the Bristol Eye Hospital. My neurologist put me on to topiramate for the migraines, and it didn't seem to help with my vision at all. It just continued to get worse and worse and worse. But by this stage, the double vision had gone. It was only 2 weeks after my first lumbar puncture that I needed to have another lumbar puncture done. I was just losing my vision. They did an emergency lumbar puncture, and then the next day they put in a shunt and they put in a reservoir on the 27th of January. Since then, it's been all right. It's been a bit strange to get used to and adapt to, but my vision has gotten so much better since then. When I was at the optoneurologist last, she said that it could take 6 to 8 weeks for the swelling to come down. I spoke to my neurologist and he said that they should be able to tell me in 18 months' time what my eyes will be like. We just have to wait to see if there's any permanent damage.
With me today is Dr. Denise Attan, neuro-ophthalmologist at University Hospital Bristol and senior clinical lecturer at Bristol Medical School. Denise, thank you for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Shannon was one of your patients, wasn't she? So would you say that her symptoms were fairly typical of papilledema?
I would say her symptoms are typical of intracranial hypertension rather than papilledema. So papilledema itself, you know, disc swelling isn't symptomatic usually until it's very advanced. But intracranial hypertension can be very symptomatic, as in Shannon's case.
And that's what gives the symptoms, the actual raised intracranial hypertension. So Shannon actually had a headache, didn't she, as well? So she had them when she first woke up in the morning.
That's right. And her headache became increasingly and progressively more severe. And the other worrying features were, of course, that she also felt sick. She was vomiting. She had double vision and she was getting visual obscurations.
So why do these symptoms happen?
So the primary problem is the intracranial hypertension, and that's why you get disc swelling. So that's why you also get headache, nausea and vomiting. One of the non-localizing neurological sequelae of intracranial hypertension is sixth nerve palsy. And so that's why she was getting double vision, because she had bilateral sixth nerve palsies as well as her papilledema.
Do patients often report a ringing in their ears or a whooshing sound?
Yes, something that sounds like their heartbeat. That is a symptom that can happen in normal people. The fact that it's persistent, severe, and associated with all the other symptoms that she had alongside that.
Mm. So if a patient came in with symptoms like that, what clinical examinations do you think we should be carrying out in practice?
I think a standard optometric examination would be required. So checking visual acuities, refractive error, checking visual fields if you have that available, intraocular pressures as well, because of course raised pressure can cause headache, and then checking the back of the eyes to check for papilledema.
Yeah, so with visual field testing, we're looking for an enlarged blind spot, aren't we?
Yes, that's the classic presentation of disc swelling, because the optic nerve head normally creates a physiological blind spot. So when the optic nerve is swollen, it's bigger in area, and so it makes a bigger blind spot on the visual field test. If papilledema is very advanced and severe, then you can get a constriction of the visual field as well as that.
So Denise, if you suspect papilledema in a patient, is it worth doing colour vision and checking their pupil reactions?
I think it's still worth checking the pupil reactions and the colour vision in any patient that you see disc swelling. However, I would expect pupil reactions and colour vision to be normal, because most patients with papilledema, you know, both optic nerves are affected equally. So you wouldn't expect to see something like an RAPD. And usually papilledema doesn't affect the colour vision. It's only very severe end of the spectrum, which is uncommon in someone with severe papilledema or chronic papilledema, where for whatever reason it's asymmetric, you might see a difference in pupil reactions or colour vision. But in 98% of cases, pupils and colour vision will be normal.
So if we do have a case of suspected papilledema, how urgently does that patient need to be seen within the hospital system?
If the patient is unwell, as in Shannon's case, she had headaches, nausea, vomiting, And her vision was affected, so her acuities were down and her visual fields were also affected, then he can't wait 2 weeks. Then that type of patient needs to be referred to an eye casualty or a main casualty.
So papilledema is optically swelling due to raised intracranial pressure. But if I saw papilledema in a child, I'd be thinking along the lines of a brain tumour instead.
So in adults and children, if you see papilledema, you should always be thinking about excluding a brain tumour first. But actually, brain tumours are quite uncommon. More commonly, papilledema is caused by idiopathic intracranial hypertension. And that condition is very strongly associated with obesity in women of reproductive age. Children can also get idiopathic intracranial hypertension as well. And children also, you know, teenagers going through puberty can be overweight. The same risk factors apply to young adults or teenagers as they do to older adults.
If I see swollen looking discs in practice, before I start to think about referring, I also need to think about the differentials as well. So Denise, can you talk us through the conditions that can be mistaken for papilledema and how we go about excluding them?
Yeah, so the sort of causes of pseudo-papilledema, in other words, the patient wouldn't have any symptoms. Even those patients with drusen, which can sometimes be associated with peripheral visual field defects, often the patient isn't aware of those peripheral visual field defects, so they'll be asymptomatic. That doesn't mean that they are immune to getting headaches, because patients with pseudopapilledema, as with the general population, will get headaches. So headache on its own is not a good sign of intracranial hypertension or papilledema.
And when we actually look at the discs themselves, there are features that we can look at to help us identify whether or not it's pseudopapilledema. So whether it's unilateral or bilateral, does that make a difference?
Not always. Drusen can affect one nerve or both nerves. It could be bilateral, it could be just one nerve. There are a number of signs that allow you to make a positive diagnosis of disc swelling rather than thinking of excluding pseudopapilledema. I think we need to try and look for positive features of swelling. So for example, loss of the optic cup, hyperemia of the blood vessels, tortuosity of the blood vessels, obscuration of the blood vessels by the swelling, cotton wool spots, hemorrhages, those sort of features. Because blood disc margins on their own is not actually a very reliable sign, because you can get blurred disc margins just from an elevated disc. And things like crowded optic discs and drusen will give you an elevated disc. That's not the same as swelling. In actual fact, when you look at a swollen disc in cross-section, usually the swelling is spreading horizontally. Although there is elevation of the disc, you see that spread out horizontally. Whereas drusen, crowded discs, it's a sort of vertical elevation. You don't see that horizontal spread.
Yes, because blurred disc margins or unusual disc margins are quite common when we look at discs. So, for example, if someone has a tilted disc or if they have a myopic crescent, they all look a little bit different, don't they?
Yeah.
So if an optometrist is concerned about disc appearance, but there are no symptoms or only vague ones, the best way forward would be to perhaps refer them for a diagnosis to make sure that the appearance of the disc is physiological, or is it best just to monitor it yourself in practice?
If you have the option to monitor it yourself and there's clearly nothing else to worry about and you think it's a crowded disc, then actually there isn't any reason to refer the patient on to secondary care. If, of course, you have diagnostic doubt, then I think the best place to refer the patients to is to ophthalmology, because they have the expertise and the equipment to distinguish different types of pseudopapilledema.
Yeah, I think that's key, isn't it? Because if we're not sure if it's pseudopapilledema or early papilledema, I think the best course of action would be to refer them to ophthalmology, because we don't have the expertise in primary care.
I think if you have things like OCT available in your own practice, it's worthwhile knowing how to interpret the images you get from OCT so that you're able to recognize drusen from any other suspicious discs. The OCT is there to help you refer the right patients to secondary care. So make sure you know how to use it.
Yes. So if you have got access, then yes, it's learning to interpret it correctly. So you're not making too many inappropriate referrals.
That's right.
Thank you, Denise. You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we'll be exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. We'd love to hear from you with any suggestions for subjects or questions you might have about any of the areas we've covered. You can email us at podcast@docket.info or tweet at Sound Optometry. I'm joined by neuro-ophthalmologist Dr. Denise Attan. Earlier, we discussed a case of bilateral disc swelling, as well as the physiological causes for pseudopapilledema. But what if only one eye has a suspicious disc? Papilledema is rarely unilateral, but what are the other and probably more likely diagnoses? So Denise, what are the red flags to look out for in history and symptoms?
Well, here I think the history is actually very key. So with optic neuritis, generally the type of population that's affected is young. They wouldn't have vascular risk factors. And what they would describe in the history is pain affecting the eye, pain affecting the eye on eye movement. That's the classic. And usually this comes on over a few days. It gets progressively worse over about a week. And then the vision stays down. And by that, I mean the acuity and the visual field stays down for up to 2-3 weeks. And then it'll tend to get better on its own. Now, the distinguishing feature between optic neuritis and anterior ischemic optic neuropathy is not just the history, but also patients with optic neuritis have disproportionately reduced colour vision. So what that means is, for example, a patient might be able to see 6/12 on a chart, something along those lines, but their colour vision would be much worse than that. So they might only be able to see a few plates of the Ishihara colour vision test. Clearly, if somebody's visual acuity is down to 660, they would struggle to see the numbers anyway, regardless of what the cause of their reduced acuity is. So that's why I say disproportionate reduction in colour vision. So much worse than you would expect from the acuity, essentially. Someone with anterior ischemic optic neuropathy would normally be an older age group. They would normally have vascular risk factors. So by that, I mean hypertension, diabetes, smoking, maybe they've got high lipids, something like that, maybe family history. The presentation would be more acute. So either they suddenly woke up with it is the classic one in the morning. Not everyone is aware that they've had an episode of ischemic optic neuropathy if it wasn't particularly painful. But generally, in 95% of patients, they will have pain, not on eye movement, just pain, because ischemia is painful. The vision would be reduced. Again, peripheral visual field defects, but colour vision, relatively spared.
That's interesting. So the symptoms are very different because these are all visual symptoms, aren't they, that you're describing, rather than the ones associated with papilledema or raised intracranial hypertension, where it was more sort of the headaches, the nausea. So it's a very different set of symptoms, aren't they? These are the ones that we are very likely to pick up on in practice.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think if you're wondering if a patient has a unilaterally swollen disc, then you're thinking along the lines of, has that patient got an optic neuropathy of some type, not papilledema? So when patients have an optic neuropathy, usually then the vision is affected. They might have an RAPD because only one nerve is affected there.
So quite often we talk about non-arteritic and arteritic anterior ischemic optic neuropathy. What is the difference between the two?
So arteritic is due to a vasculitis type problem. The classic underlying diagnosis is giant cell arteritis in older people over 60. Those patients might get temporal headache and tenderness. The presentation is actually like an anterior ischemic optic neuropathy, but usually much more severe and much acuter. But other than that, all the other features are exactly like an anterior ischemic optic neuropathy. So in an older person who doesn't have vascular risk factors, is complaining of temporal tenderness, temporal headache, and some of the other features of giant cell arteritis, for example, jaw claudication. What that means is pain in the jaw, not at the beginning of starting to eat, but that develops as they continue to chew. Usually there are other symptoms that have been going on for a while before that. So loss of appetite, loss of weight. There might even be other systemic symptoms like night sweats, and, you know, they feel unwell and they kind of look unwell often as well.
So if a patient has got these general symptoms of not being well, is it possible that their vision isn't much affected yet and that when you look at their optic disc, it can look reasonably normal still?
You're right. I mean, patients can present with giant cell arteritis before their vision is affected, but then they probably wouldn't present to you. They go to their GP. And actually, the referral pathway and management is a little bit different. If vision isn't affected, they would tend to be referred to rheumatology. If their vision is affected, they would tend to be referred to ophthalmology. The treatment is also different. So if patients do not have vision affected, they're seen by the rheumatologist, they're normally started on oral steroids. If they're referred to ophthalmology and the vision's affected, usually they're started on intravenous steroids, quite a high dose for a number of days, and then begin oral steroids. And the reason for doing that is those patients that have vision affected, there's quite a high risk that their other eye might be affected too.
So again, if we saw this in practice, they are likely to have, as you say, ocular symptoms because that's why they presented to the optometrist. Would you say it needs to be an emergency referral?
It would be same day. Mm-hmm. There's a risk that they might go blind in both eyes if you don't refer the same day.
Yeah. So as a final message to optometrists in practice, when they do see a funny looking disc and they're trying to decide what to do, do you have any top tips for those optometrists?
As we were discussing earlier, I think you need to look for the positive signs of swelling. Actually look for vessel obscuration, loss of cup, all the things I mentioned earlier. When you think someone might have pseudopapilledema, again, you're looking for the positive signs of that. Does it look like drusen? Can you see those sort of crystalline deposits on the surface there? Is it a tilted disc? Tilted disc, often there's a temporal crescent of atrophy. The disc, rather than being circular in shape, it looks kind of oblong, if you like, because of the tilt. Look hard for the edge of the optic nerve in somebody who might have peripapillary atrophy. Because usually if you look hard enough, you can see that there is a clear margin to the disc.
Yeah, so you really need to stop and think and say, hold on a minute, okay, I suspect this, but what evidence can I actually see when I look at that disc?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely right.
And again, looking at the whole picture before deciding, rather than pressing the panic button straight away and jumping to conclusions.
Yeah, I think so. And the other thing I say is, you're not the patient's doctor. If a patient's got symptoms that you're worried about, but actually their discs are normal, send them to their GP. And I don't mean to take anything away from optometrists, because clearly you have much better expertise than GPs in examining the eye. So there really does need to be a kind of symbiotic relationship between GPs and optometrists. So GPs rely on optometrists to be able to examine the eyes and give them that information. But then you should rely on the GPs then to use that information and make a medical or clinical decision based on that information.
I think you've made a really good point there, because there are a lot of fast track pathways and we are encouraged to refer to ophthalmology directly where appropriate. So quite often we don't actually refer to the GP, we just notify them. And I think it's important to remember that actually the GP, as you say, has an overview of the whole patient history, their medical history and of their conditions. And so it's definitely worth keeping them in the loop and actually referring to the GP if there are no overriding local pathways. So thank you for that reminder.
Absolutely.
Denise, thank you for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you would like more information about the topics in this episode, go to our website, docit.info, and search for sound optometry to find the reading materials. Listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise will gain one CET point. If you would like to learn more about papilledema and pseudopapilledema, Denise explains the topic in detail with some great OCT images in our recent Docket webinar. Just click on the webinar button from the docket.info homepage to gain access. We'd really appreciate it if you help spread the word about the podcast. Tell your colleagues to listen or subscribe to the series so you don't miss an episode. And next time, we'll be discussing keratoconus. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening. Thank you.